plant has been constructed, the detectors have been built, and they're making good progress towards getting to astrophysical sensitivity. So they're not the presently, these detectors are taking astrophysical science data. GEO-600 is helping out in a way that I'll talk about in a minute. And then Virgo and Kagra have their detectors built in various different stages. Virgo is further along than Kagra, and then India is in the planning stages. So I'll explain exactly what's going on there. Why do we want an international network of gravitational wave detectors? Well, one of the key things is multi-messenger astronomy. We want to be able to use gravitational wave detectors. Our present gravitational wave detectors are high-frequency gravitational wave detectors. The ground-based detectors, as Lisa said, are limited by seismic noise at low frequencies. So they're looking in the audio band of tens to kilohertz. I'm not going to mention the lower frequencies, the millihertz for the space-based detectors. There are plans for LISA and other future space-based detectors. And then at even lower frequency, there are pulsar timing arrays. So we have a full gravitational wave spectrum to explore from the high-frequency ground-based detectors to the low-frequency, the pulsar timing arrays. But I'm just going to constrain myself in this talk to the ground-based, high-frequency detectors. So detectors like LIGO. Why do we care about a global network? Well, this cartoon from Edo's review, originally from Metzger and Berger, shows the possible emission mechanisms from a binary merger, so a neutron star black hole merger or a binary neutron star merger, where there's matter involved. There can be prompt emission of gamma rays, off-axis X-ray emission, and then perhaps kilonova emission from our process elements that are kicked out. Once they become opaque, they decay and give off signatures in the red or the infrared, and then radio signatures from the material hitting the interstellar medium and shocks. So bringing this all together is the goal of this network, to have multiple detectors that have long baselines, good sky localization, that can get us not just the gravitational wave detections, but be able to point telescopes of all different frequencies at these sources, bring everything together, and tell us about the compact objects that are produced by core collapse supernova, by stellar evolution, and bring that back to the origin and evolution and fate of massive stars. So that's one of the primary goals of the international network. Multi-messenger astronomy is not the be-all and end-all. The binary black hole discoveries, personally, I expect binary black hole mergers to be quiet in the electromagnetic bands. There have been some papers that propose that maybe there are some EM signatures. We can take a poll over beer of who believes those and who doesn't. But binary black hole mergers are opportunity to explore the compact remnants, to get the masses, to get the spins of these products of core collapse supernova. And to paraphrase Cole Miller, gravitational wave astronomy is kind of a unique field in the sense that because we're really, really struggling to build detectors that are just sensitive enough to detect gravitational waves above the noise level in the detectors, our theory is actually very advanced. So the GR theory of our sources is actually very advanced in terms of describing the gravitational waves that are emitted as two black holes spiral down towards each other. Numerical relativity gives us very good descriptions, post-Newtonian theory. We have very good descriptions. There's some open questions that I'll talk about towards the end, but we have very good theoretical descriptions of the sources. And we need that to be able to dig into our noise and find these sources, as opposed to, say, you know, electromagnetic sources where you can find a supernova, you can collect the photons fairly easily, and then the question is puzzling over the physics that drove that supernova engine. And so the observations are driving the theory. But because we have very good theoretical production of these sources, we can measure very accurately the masses, spins, orientation angles of these compact objects, and that information can then go and feed theories of massive star evolution. Okay, so I added this plot given Chris's question. So this is a fairly old plot. It's from 2010, from this GWIC roadmap, the Gravitational Wave International Committee. This is a noise plot again, so gravitational wave frequency on the x-axis and then amplitude spectral density of the noise on the y-axis. So this shows the predicted noise level for the menagerie of international projects that are out there. This is initial LIGO, done and dusted, initial Virgo. Those detectors don't exist anymore. Virgo Plus, that was an upgrade to Virgo that doesn't exist anymore. The present generation is advanced Virgo right here, advanced LIGO. LCGT, this is now called CAGRA. It was called LCGT when the GWT roadmap was written, but this is the CAGRA noise curve. And then up here is a project called GeoHF, which is the 600 meter geo detector in Germany. So this is the collection of detectors. And then Einstein Telescope, which is the concept that Lisa talked about at the end of her talk. This is a true underground detector, getting with long arms and a triangle configuration. So this is the current generation of detectors, and then we're talking going factors of 10 to the future generation of detectors. Okay, to calibrate this, let me show you where we are. Let me superimpose the plot that that Vicky and Lisa showed on here. So these are the three binary black hole mergers that we've seen, and then this is the measured sensitivity from Hanford and Livingston from the first observing run. So this is the roadmap, and then this is the present right here with the O1 results. The punchline to take away from this is that LIGO, the American LIGO, the US LIGO, LIGO India, which will be which is underway now, CAGRA in Japan, and Virgo are all kilometer class interferometers and all have roughly the same sensitivity when they reach design. The question is when is it that they'll reach design? This plot right here shows the detectability of different sources. So this is for 30 solar mass black holes, detectability for different detectors, for 30 solar mass black holes. So as a function of redshift, this is the signal to noise ratio we expect for different classes of detectors. So, you know, the question that sometimes comes up, would you have seen 15.914 in S6? No, because it was below the level of detectability. You know, could you have seen something, could 15.06 have been louder? Yes, it have been better oriented for the detectors. The LIGO detectors are not uniformly sensitive. They have a beam pattern. All the gravitational wave detectors have a beam pattern. They're most sensitive directly above the detectors and have little sensitivity if a signal comes down the arms or it causes the same stretching and squeezing in both arms. So GW159914 was not optimally oriented. A similar source could have had a higher SNR if it was better oriented, and we could have got better parameter estimation and better constraints out. So this is where things were for O1, for the advanced LIGO design, and then for future upgrades. We're talking, you know, signal noises of tens and hundreds for these sources. So really pulling out a lot of information from the parameter estimation when we get improved sensitivity. And Ben will talk about that in his talk later. Okay, so what about the status of the current network? So let me first talk about, Lisa talked a lot about LIGO, so I will completely ignore LIGO in my talk. And I'll start with GEO600 in Germany. So the GEO600 detector, which is shown here, the arms run along the side of this field right here. GEO is a prototype detector for testing next generation technology for advanced detectors. And it's currently the only detector using squeeze light in regular operation. So they are leading the way in terms of squeezing, improving the high frequency laser noise by injecting squeeze vacuum into the detectors. And they're prototyping advanced technologies. One of the other things that GEO does is they operate in AstroWatch mode. So they try and take data as much as possible. The LIGO detectors don't have 100% duty cycle. And even worse, they have periods where they will be down for commissioning and not observing the universe at all. And so what GEO does is GEO tries to fill in those gaps. When we are down for commissioning between O2 and O3, GEO will be operating in AstroWatch mode while they'll be taking data. Now they don't have as good sensitivity as LIGO. They're, as I showed on the first plot, they are quite a bit less sensitive than the LIGO detectors. But if LIGO got unlucky and there was a nearby supernova in the galaxy during the time between August 2016 and September 2017, when LIGO comes back online, GEO will be providing some coverage and may be able to extract some gravitational signature from anything that happened nearby during the commissioning periods. So GEO is basically a detector that does next generation technology upgrades, as well as providing coverage when the LIGO detectors are down for commissioning. Okay, so coming back to the kilometer scale detectors. So this is Virgo in Italy. Virgo is a 3 kilometer detector. So it's a kilometer cast detector. Remember, LIGO is 4 kilometers. So Virgo is never quite going to hit the same sensitivity as LIGO because its arms are 3 kilometers long versus 4 kilometers long. So these detectors are all comparable, but LIGO is the most sensitive of the kilometer class detectors, both because of its technologies and it has that edge in arm length, and the strain sensitivity scales as the arm length. It's technologically similar to LIGO in some ways. The optical layout is very similar. It's a dual recycled Fabry-Perot Michelson interferometer. It has some technological differences. The suspensions, the seismic suspensions, the seismic isolation in Virgo is passive, whereas in LIGO it's active seismic isolation. So there are technological differences between the two detectors, but they're very similar in terms of the science that they can do. One thing to note is that there is, and has been for many years, full data sharing between the LIGO scientific collaboration and the Virgo collaboration. The two detectors are operated independently. Virgo is operated by EGO, LIGO is operated by the LIGO lab, but the data analysis, the astrophysics, everything is done together as one collaboration. So there's full data sharing between the LIGO and Virgo collaborations. So what is the state of Virgo? So this is a, if you care day to day about what the state of the detectors are, both all the sites have these logbooks where you can go and you can be nosy about the status of the detector. This is all public information. This is a log entry from Wednesday, March 22nd, and Virgo is locking for getting hour-long locks on their dark fringe. So the Virgo detector has been built, it's been constructed, and they're in the early stages of commissioning to their early sensitivities for joining in with the advanced LIGO run, hopefully this summer. So this is, I asked Lisa if she could remember when this happened in LIGO. She said, I don't remember exactly when that happened. It was, Livingston, it was May 2014, is that right? So May 2014 in Livingston. And so from that point, May 2014, getting up to design sensitivity. So this is kind of where Virgo is. They have the experience from LIGO commissioning. They have, they're making rapid progress. One thing that I think we should give the Virgo people credit for is they're not that far behind LIGO. The plan was always for Virgo to follow LIGO in terms of the commissioning schedule. They've faced some fairly steep obstacles. They've had blade springs fracturing. They've had the monolithic suspension wires that they hang their mirrors from have been shattering due to contamination of the vacuum. So they've actually faced some fairly serious technological challenges that they've understood and overcome recently. And so they're making good progress in terms of getting towards their sensitivities. And I'm optimistic that they'll join us for a run this summer. And I'll talk about the implications of that in a second. So as Lisa said, this is the documents from the projected noise curves for the commissioning observing document. This is the one that Lisa showed for LIGO. So again, this is gravitational wave frequency on the x-axis and amplitude spectral density of the noise on the y-axis. This is the phase commissioning plan for advanced LIGO, and this is the phase commissioning plan for advanced Virgo. And these are again quoted in BNS ranges. So the bineutron star range is the distance at which a randomly oriented binary neutron star source will produce a signal noise ratio of 8 in a single detector. So these are not binary black hole ranges, these are BNS ranges. At design sensitivity, advanced LIGO is 200 megaparsecs, advanced Virgo is 130 megaparsecs. The difference here is partly due to the arm length and partly due to slightly better low frequency sensitivity in the LIGO detector. So this is the plan, the phase plan for the commissioning of the advanced Virgo and the advanced LIGO detectors. As I said, Virgo faced some fairly serious technological challenges, and one of the major technological challenges that they faced is fracturing of the glass fibers that hang their mirrors, the monolithic suspensions for the Virgo mirrors. And they had several of these fibers shattering. It turns out that this was contamination of the vacuum of metal particles from a scroll pump that were getting into the vacuum and causing these wires to fracture. They've mitigated that, but they haven't been able to go back to monolithic suspensions for the first advanced Virgo run. So given that they don't have monolithic suspensions, what they've done is they've hung the mirrors, they've gone back to hanging the mirrors from steel wires, as we did in the initial generation detectors. This is the projected Virgo sensitivity superimposed on top of the roadmap for commissioning that Virgo expect to have when they come online this summer for their first observing run. And most of this loss comes from the fact they're using steel wires instead of monolithic suspensions. The binary neutron star range for this is about 20 megaparsecs. So it's in the tens of megaparsecs, so the upper end of the initial detector, but not quite as sensitive as the LIGO detectors. One of the things, though, you know, that's the bad news. Virgo won't be as sensitive as we hope for O1. The good news is that adding a third detector gives you sky localization, even if that third detector is not as sensitive as the other two detectors. You can use two detectors to make the detection. If you know where the signal is, then you can dig into the data of the third less sensitive detector to constrain the sky localization of the signal. And this is the sky map we got for the probable location of the GW50 and the 914 merger. This was a very loud signal. This was much louder than I think any of us were expecting to see for the first detections. This was an extremely loud binary black hole merger in the first science run. Yet we still have these giant bananas on the sky for possible locations. And this is a plot that Leo Singer made that says, okay, suppose this is a binary neutron star instead of a binary black hole system, because it's binary neutron stars we care about for the sky localization. Suppose we got a BNS system with the same signal-to-noise ratio as 50 and 914, and we got lucky. Then what would adding Virgo in with only 25% the sensitivity of advanced LIGO give you? So suppose we have two LIGO detectors with comparable sensitivity, and we add in Virgo with a range that's 25% of LIGO's range, then the sky localization here drops from this large circle here down to this smaller circle here, even with only 25% the range in Virgo. So adding in the Virgo detector, because you can go in and you can get that sky localization constraint and the parameter estimation when you go and dig into Virgo noise, does add something. So it's not all bad news that Virgo's coming online. The summary of the study that Leo did is that Virgo's range is 25% of LIGO, then the LIGO-only sky localizations are reduced by a factor of 60%, which is non-trivial. Yes. Yeah. That's the because we the analysis is done jointly, and so this analysis can be done together. Okay, so let me turn to Kagra in Japan. So Kagra is currently an independent collaboration to the LIGO Scientific Collaboration and Virgo, but they're very interested in working with us, obviously, and there's technology sharing and information sharing going on between the Kagra and LIGO collaborations. So Kagra is a 3 km detector, so the same length as Virgo, underground in the Kamioka mine. It has a similar optical layout to advanced LIGO, but different technologies in the detector because it uses cryogenic cooling to reduce the mirror thermal noise. So rather than using these big fused silica, these big glass mirrors that LIGO uses, they're actually using sapphire mirrors and trying to cryogenically cool the mirrors to reduce the thermal noise of the mirror. So they're using a fundamentally different technology than LIGO is. So this is the artist's impression under the Kamioka mine, and Super K is somewhere around here. This detector exists. It's real. It's not something that only exists on paper. The construction of the Kagra-Michelson interferometer is complete. They incredibly quickly drilled these tunnels in the mine. They've put vacuum tubes in. They've put all the suspensions, the start of the core optics in. So this is the X-arm tunnel and vacuum tubes. This is the Y-arm tunnel and vacuum tubes. And Kagra have recently operated a 3 km Michelson interferometer. So they have the beam splitter and the two N-test masses, and they've locked a 3 km Michelson interferometer. When you ask them about the sensitivity, they say, "Well, it's a 3 km Michelson, but we're not going to quote any astrophysical sensitivity yet, but it's good progress in terms of their technology." The next stage for Kagra, this I think they called this iKagra, just to get some initial locking on the 3 km Michelson. The next stage is cryogenic operation of the 3 km Michelson in early 2018. That's the next step for Kagra. And then their sensitivity design, this is a paper taken from a paper by the Kagra collaboration. Their sensitivity design is 140 megaparsecs to binary neutron stars, so comparable to Virgo. And from what the expectation is, their design will be somewhere around 2022, 2023 is expected design for Kagra. Okay, so moving on from constructed to and commission and in progress of commissioning to planned detectors, let me talk about LIGO India. So LIGO India is a direct partnership between the LIGO laboratory and the INDIGO collaboration to build an Indian interferometer. Now, some of you may remember, if you're paying attention with initial LIGO, that at Hanford, we had two interferometers. We had a 4-kilometer interferometer and a 2-kilometer interferometer. In advanced LIGO, we decided to mothball and advanced LIGO was budgeted for three interferometers, the same as initial LIGO. We made the decision to mothball one of those interferometers, to put it in storage and to only build 2 4-kilometer LIGO detectors at the Hanford and Limpsfield Observatories. And there was a partnership developed between the National Science Foundation and the US government and the Indian governments to take the advanced LIGO optics that were scheduled for installation into Hanford as a second detector in Hanford and build a third observatory in India. That gives us a much better baseline. It's on the Indian subcontinent, much better sky localization. And the important thing to note as well is that LIGO India is operated as part of LIGO. It's not an independent project like CAGRA. The detector's not independently managed like CAGRA and Virgo. It's actually part of the LIGO laboratory. And all the paperwork has been signed. It's a high priority to the Indian government. Funding is flowing. Site selection has converged on a prime site. The quote from Dave at the LSC meeting last week was, "I can't tell you where it is yet, but if you Google LIGO India site, you can probably figure it out." and acquisition of the land has begun. A very well-developed project schedule has been put together by the project coordinators for LIGO and for the INDIGO project, and this is consistent with LIGO India observations beginning in January 2024. And so this is building an advanced LIGO class detector, but by the time this is operational, we'll know more about, you know, we'll have had many years of experience with the existing advanced LIGO class detectors. So the sensitivity of LIGO India will be commensurate with, I would expect, LIGO app on a 2024 frame. Okay, let me in the last few minutes just say something that's come up in conversations this week. How much time do I have left, Delia? Okay, good. So let me just comment on something that's come up in conversations this week, and Selma asked this question of Vicky on Monday. So the official statement for the collaboration is that as of February 23rd, 3 candidate events identified by online pipelines using a loose false alarm rate threshold of 1 per month have been identified and shared with astronomers. And this, if you go to the LIGO news page, this will be updated once a month to tell you what has been sent out to the EM partners. So, you know, does this mean you should expect, you know, 3 PRLs coming out or 3 Nature papers coming out in the near future? Well, let me tell you a little bit. I'm not going to answer that question, but I'll just tell you a little bit how these searches work. I'll tell you a little bit how these searches work. So what we do is we basically, given these models of the signals I talked about, we basically dig into the data and look for all different models of the signals. And the target space we're looking for doesn't just cover binary black holes, obviously. It doesn't just cover the region we've detected. So the search space, this is the O1 search space. The O2 search space is actually broader than this. It goes up to higher masses. So we search for compact object mergers from all the way down to the component masses being 1 solar masses. So the lowest end of what people think is plausible for neutron star masses, all the way up to as high as we can go, limited by detector sensitivity. So as the masses of the compact objects get larger, they inspire more quickly, they lose energy to gravitational waves faster, the signals are shorter, and so they coalesce at lower and lower frequencies. And eventually you get to high enough masses that will actually move out the LIGO band, and you have to go to LISA for supermassive black holes and even more massive stuff down to pulsar timing. So we basically go down to 1-1, just set by our knowledge of neutron stars, all the way up as high as we can go based on the character of the LIGO noise curve. So this is our binary black hole region, this is our neutron star black hole region, and this is our binary neutron star region. And these alerts that we're sending out cover both the binary black hole region and the neutron star black hole region. So what does the output of one of these searches look like? This is a plot that I think Dave or Gabby showed at one of the press conferences. This plot basically shows us, this is the output of one of these compact binary searches. So this is how loud the signal is. So this is a measure of the loudness of the signal. And then this is the rate at which we observe signals. And we measure the significance of our signals by comparing what we see to a measurement of the noise background in the detector. So this is where we compute our false alarm rates from. So this signal right here that stands way above, so this is the noise, these are two different measures of the noise background down here. Ignore the black one for a moment. The black one, the noise background, is actually contaminated by GW509914, because GW509914 is so loud. This is the noise background with 509914 taken out. So to assess the significance of these signals, you compare where these things lie to what you would expect from the noise background. And the noise background we expect at a loudness of 509914 is way down here, so this is a really significant signal. Here's the Boxing Day event, 15-12-26, and here's LVT 15-10-12. So all of these are pretty significant signals. A slightly different way of looking at it. Let me just skip this, and I'll show you. This is the plot with I've removed 15-09-14 from this plot because 15-09-14 is so loud it contaminates this background. Even Boxing Day kind of contaminates the background a little bit, and I can explain that. It's a technical detail, but focus on the curve. This plot that Colin Capano, who's here, this is a plot that Colin made, and Chris Beers, another person who's here, did a lot of work on these searches. This plot shows, the loudness of the signal against the false alarm rate that we expect at that loudness. So this basically allows you to translate between, you know, what is a false alarm rate from the search and how loud is the signal in SNR. And here's the Boxing Day event, which is louder than all the backgrounds. So we estimate this to be a bigger than 5 sigma detection. Its false alarm rate is one in many hundreds of thousands of years. And here's LVT 15-10-12, right? It's not as loud as this guy, so this is the loudness. So LVT 15-10-12 is not as loud. But if we use the map, this gray curve gives us the map between the loudness and the expected background, then this is a 1 in 2 year event. So this is a little bit more than 2 sigma event from the detections. Given that we've detected binary black holes, we can measure the rate of binary black hole mergers. And so this is described in great detail. There's an APJ letter, an APJ supplement, and then in the PRX it summarizes the whole run. We can use the observed binary black hole merger rate to measure the event rate. And this rate can be used to assign a probability that a given trigger is of astrophysical origin. And we do it in a much more complicated way, but it's roughly you can determine the probability of something astrophysical origin by taking the measured rate of these signals divided by the false alarm rate of the trigger that's coming out of the search. So that gives you a rough idea of the astrophysical origin. When you do this carefully with a much better analysis for LVT 15-10-12, you find out the probability that this is astrophysical origin and not just due to noise is about 87%. So when people talk about we've seen 1.9 signals, that's where the 0.9 comes from. So what about binary neutron stars? Well, this is the result in addition to detecting binary black holes in O1, we did not detect binary neutron stars or neutron black hole signals in O1. We searched all the data I showed you the parameter space we searched earlier, it covers the whole space of compact objects, and we didn't detect any binary neutron star signals or neutron star black hole signals in O1. And these red bands here show the region of parameter space that we excluded. That's not inconsistent with the rate predictions. This is the menagerie of different rate predictions for binary neutron star systems and for neutron star black hole rates. There's a lot of uncertainty in these rate predictions. So the non-detection in O1 is consistent with what we expect from the rates. Okay, so how might you interpret the fact that LIGO sends out triggers at a false alarm rate of roughly 1 per month for example, binary neutron star triggers? Well, here's the map between the false alarm rate and the loudness of the signal for these types of systems. So if I send out triggers at a false alarm rate of 1 a month, I'm roughly here. These are pretty quiet sources, right? And so I can take that false alarm rate. You could pick your favorite astrophysicist prediction model for these sources and get a probability that these things are astrophysical. And so if we're sending out triggers from the whole mass space, 1 per month doesn't necessarily mean, you know, it's definitely a detection. It means that we're sending out triggers because we want EM partners, and our EM partners have asked to follow up candidates, both from the marginal all the way to the gold-plated 5 sigma detections. And when Lisa's talking about, you know, binary neutron star ranges at SNR 8, you know, this is the network SNR, so it's the square root of the sum of the single detector SNRs. 8.8 is 11.3, and so that's actually a 5 sigma detection down here. So what we're sending out is kind of everything from here all the way out to the confident detections. So let me just close by saying, this is the plot that Vicky showed. This is the measured binary black hole coalescence rate, 9 to 240 per year. Here's our probability of detecting at least 2 signals, at least 10 signals, and 40 signals in O2 and O3. Now, one thing I'll note is that this projected detection rate assumes two detector coincidences. And the network range, when you assume two detector coincidences, is set by the second most sensitive detector, which is currently Hanford. And we have more detector data than goes into the two detector pile. We have single detector data. So speaking for myself and not the LIGO Scientific Collaboration, although people in the collaboration have discussed this, you know, perhaps we should be going after a higher event rate for binary black holes where we know these sources exist, going after binary black holes in single detector time and increasing our event rate beyond the predictions from the network. And for the massive stars community, that's not crazy as well, because we want masses and spins of the progenitor compact objects to feed into stellar evolution. And for a single detector, you can get those masses and spins pretty well. Having a network does actually give you an advantage in measuring the masses and the spins, because if you're a stellar modeler, you want the source frame masses. And so we need to take redshift into account. So there is actually a degeneracy between the inclination angle and the distance, which having a network gets better. But one of the studies we're looking at right now is how accurate could you get single detector detections and bump up this rate even further and provide even more information and measure dN by dZ, the mass distribution, all these great things that we can provide to the massive stars community. Okay, I'll stop there.
Just ask for a quick clarification. When you were discussing the alerts that LIGO was putting out, you were discussing the uncertainty or the false alarm rate relative to the binary star, binary black hole expectations.
Right.
But am I correct in remembering that some of the alerts may not be associated with compact binary coalescence searches at all?
That's right. So the there are two classes of pipelines, two classes of searches within the LSC. There are compact binary searches, and that targets these CBC the merging binaries, and then there are unmodeled burst searches, and coherent wave burst is one of the main unmodeled burst searches. So there are searches that are looking for unmodeled systems. So the model systems is not the end of the story. Particularly as we're saying on Monday, you know, eccentric binaries, we don't have templates for eccentric binaries yet. Supernova core collapse, if we got lucky, the binary search is not going to find those because the waveform's completely different. So we have burst searches that are generating alerts and sending them out as well.
So for those of us who are not in the collaboration, some of those three alerts could actually be associated with burst searches, may not even be the one per month false alarm rate candidates from compact binary.
Exactly. Yes, that is correct.
So quick clarification, is there no analysis of single detectors right now?
There is analysis of single detectors. So one of the things we did after 01 is when we do both the low latency alerts have to be triggered by a multi-detector analysis. A single detector for low latency doesn't make any sense. But when we do the offline analysis, where we go back and we apply better data quality, better calibration, we always look at the single detector triggers as well now and make sure that we're not ignoring the single detector triggers.
I had the same question. Okay.
It's now a tab on the PyCBC result pages, which is, you know, show me all the coinks and show me all the singles.
Hey, I was just wondering when do alerts or if alerts will become public at some point, not just inside the collaboration?
03. That was approved at the LSC meeting last week. I think that is independent of. My recollection of the council meeting last week is that alerts are public in 03. I mean, we expect the threshold was 4, and we're almost there. So, and you can calculate whether or not that threshold will be satisfied. So I think that's somewhat of a moot question. 03 public alerts.
More questions?
Do you have any agreements with GAGRA in order to do efficient EM follow-up?
Not yet, but they're in the works. So CAGRA is in the stage where Virgo is at the point where they are months away from taking astrophysically interesting data based on, you know, they won't be as sensitive, but they can get better sky localizations. CAGRA is in the stage where they are still several years away from taking astrophysically interesting data.
Summer?
I wanted to ask about eccentric systems. I don't know if I've understood this well, but I understood that there's not a long in spiral, so it's more a burst event. Is there an upper limit on eccentric mergers from the data that's now there?
Let me address the first part, the statement here first. So Currently, we don't search. We don't have eccentric templates. There's a search being commissioned for eccentric templates. The priority has been implement the waveforms without spin. That's what we did in initial LIGO. And then the first priority for the compact binary searches in advanced LIGO is to add in the spins of the compact objects. We actually neglected the spin in initial LIGO for the most part. And so in advanced LIGO, we take into account the spins of the compact objects. Then the next thing on the list is higher harmonics, and then adding in eccentricity searches. So Amber Lennon and Belinda Cheeseborough, who are grad students at West Virginia, they're working on commissioning eccentric search right now. The burst search gives you upper limits on, so if you do a search for the O1 burst search papers, they give upper limits on generic unmodeled signals, but I don't think the burst searches have actually done large campaigns of injecting eccentric signals to measure the specific upper limits for eccentric signals, but that's in the works.
I mean, I think that has been done before, but as far as I know, not actually published.
It's in the works, but there's not a paper on it.
I mean, it's also maybe worth pointing out that actually for mild eccentricities, the existing searches are quite decent at picking it up, right? So in fact, GW5914 could have had an eccentricity of 0.1 for all we know. We wouldn't even have been able to tell the difference.
Yeah, I won't dig up the plot now, but there's a paper, Elie Huerta and I wrote a paper a few years ago where we basically we showed for just the detection searches, the loss of the detection range for eccentricity, and for low eccentricities of 0.002, there's no difference whatsoever. As you get to 0.1, it starts to drop off, but not horribly. When you get to 0.4, you've lost quite a bit of the range. And so you could take that plot and you could probably, you know, just multiply the upper limits are basically 1 over VT, right? So if you wanted to do your own back of the envelope calculation on limits and eccentric binaries, you could take the plot from Brown and Huerta and then scale back the V based on the loss in SNR in that paper.
And there's also a mass dependence statement, so the higher the mass, you have fewer cycles in band.
Exactly.
And therefore can get away with even higher eccentricities.
Exactly, yep.
Without being adversely affected.
Yep.
Speaking of, Douglas.
So Duncan, we had this survey of surveys session where at the end I said maybe people should stop building new surveys. So my question to you is somewhat contentious, which is if I look at what's happening with CAGRA, I'm asking to myself, why are we doing LIGO India? Everything I'm seeing from CAGRA looks to me like they can reach the sensitivity of O2 with a pretty high probability of success given what I'm seeing so far in other projects. So maybe you can't answer it, but maybe the question you could answer is, is CAGRA's expectation to be at the presently O2 level?
CAGRA is, and this is a personal opinion, not a collaboration opinion, obviously. CAGRA has a very ambitious goal of delivering cryogenic. They need their cryogenic operation to get to that sensitivity. They won't get to comparable to advanced LIGO sensitivity without the cryogenics working. No one has ever tried to build a cryogenic interferometer. LIGO India is a detector built by a team who's built two already in collaboration with the group in India using well-established, well-proven technologies. We can take a bet offline as to which one will hit sensitivity first.
If in the universe there exist two solar mass black holes next to two solar mass neutron stars, would the sensitivity for such things be different? Are there templates for such things? Would LIGO find them?
Yes. So if there are the post-Newtonian templates that we use at the low mass ends basically assume the objects are point objects. They don't assume any structure. So you can search for the templates you use to search for two solar mass objects are basically the same for binary neutron stars as the alpha binary black holes. The difference becomes that we don't expect binary neutron stars to have spins that are particularly large, right? So the double neutron stars, the spins are in GR dimensionless units from A, 0 to 1. The spins are, for the observed double pulsar systems, it's like 0.05, right? The fastest millisecond pulsars are 0.4. In principle, a two solar mass binary black hole could have a spin all the way up to 0.99999, whatever the maximal spin you can come up with is. So if you saw a two solar mass source that had very high spins, you might start to think, is this really a neutron star? Because there's no plausible equations of state that will support a neutron star spinning faster than 0.7. And so that would challenge things, but the searches would find them. The spinning searches, the templates we use would find two solar mass black holes as well as two solar mass neutron stars, but it's really the spin that distinguishes them. Or you could look for, if you have two binary black holes inspiring around each other, then there's a very precise prediction of what the tidal moment induced on each Kerr black hole is going to be. For binary neutron stars, that induced quadrupolar deformation on each object depends on the nuclear equation of state. And that's something, I didn't mention this in this talk, but measuring the nuclear equation of state is something obviously you want to do with binary neutron star sources. And that's an area where the modeling actually lacks is lagging behind a little bit, and there's a lot of effort to do the nuclear modeling to get the equation of state imprint on the waveform, either in the pre-merger signature, so the effect of the fact that these aren't point objects and they're deformed in a way that they're fluffy 12-kilometer objects that deform in a way that's dependent on the nuclear equation of state, or they could be Kerr black holes, so adding that extra information in, or then getting the merger signature, or then post-merger hypermassive neutron star signature. So that's where you could get handles on distinguishing between binary black holes and binary neutron stars.
Duncan, when you were answering Lars's question, you mentioned that Kagra needs are cryogenics, but it's actually kind of strange that the design for Kagra that you pointed at was basically roughly the same as the design for Virgo, which doesn't require cryogenics. So why is it that cryogenics don't actually seemingly buy you very much, given that the length of Kagra is the same as the length of Virgo?
Again, speaking for myself, I think that my understanding is that I think Kagra had to do something ambitious to get funded. And I think that they are cryogenics is something that people are exploring for third generation technologies, right? Just like GEO has prototype squeezing, like future generations, they wanted to do something ambitious that would put a flag in the ground for some new technologies rather than just building another LIGO. And I think that's perhaps one of the reasons they went with a cryogenic detector rather than just, oh, we'll just, you know.
Very, very different suspension. I think the question is, the naive question would be, if it's the same length, what is it about the design that kind of hurts you on the sensitivity? Is it a totally different suspension system?
Smaller merits.
One of the main thing is that, so in order to go to cryogenic, they have to change material of the test masses, so they're using sapphire instead of fused silica. It is a technological problem that you cannot make very big pieces of sapphire, so the actual test mass for Kagra is 10 kilograms instead of 40. That means that the amount of power that you can put in, such that you don't get too much noise at low frequency, is lower. And so this is all kind of balancing out. So the improvement that you get from the fact that you go to lower temperature, and so the thermal noise goes down, somehow balanced by the fact that you can't quite put enough, the same amount of power. So this is.
Okay. Oh, sorry. Since you already got to ask two.
So astrophysically speaking, what could bursts be? I know like some supernova, but that would have to be super nearby, like a galactic supernova or something, right? So, but then maybe these eccentric things, I presume they could look like bursts or something, or are they just like, who knows, maybe the universe does some crazy stuff and maybe it bursts and that's why you would look for them. Or could we just not resolve the ringing and that show up as a burst or something?
So let me interpret the question as, why'd you do a burst search? You know, what are you going
to
do?
Okay. I mean. Yeah.
So the burst search serves two purposes. One is to go after things like, you know, there is a non-zero chance. I mean, we're building neutrino detectors and things like, we're operating neutrino detectors. There's a non-zero chance that we'll get a supernova signature near enough that LIGO can see it, which is within 100 kiloparsecs or so, right? It's a small chance, but it's a non-zero chance, and we don't want to miss that. So the burst searches go after that. They go after the, you know, the unknown, speculative, who knows what's there, high risk, high reward, that maybe there's nothing there. And if there was something there with some unknown signature that's not a supernova, it would take a lot of convincing, I think, to convince people that we'd seen something. But they also go after the catch-all for, if the compact binary searches aren't modeling things accurately like the eccentric searches. So they're basically backstoppers that they'll get loud. They have less sensitivity because they're not using optimal filtering. They're using they're basically looking for coherent power between the two detectors. So they ignore the phase information, just look at the coherent power in the detectors. So say I want coherent power, and coherent wave burst actually produces puts an extra cut in on one of their searches, which is I want the power to sweep up. Right, so I'll catch things that look in spirally but might not be caught by the compact binary searches. So maybe some crazy processing search that we haven't fully commissioned procession in the compact binary searches, right? So we're using aligned spin templates, which can capture a non-trivial amount of processing systems, but not all of the processing systems. Processing systems are very interesting. So the burst search backstops the compact binary searches while those new searches are being commissioned. So the science case is basically supernova, unknown things, and regions of the compact binary space where we haven't commissioned searches yet. At the high end, where you know compact binary signals are so short, it basically looks like a sine Gaussian, because you've seen the last cycle of merger and inspiral ring down. Right now, I think some of the burst searches with the coherent methods are actually a bit more sensitive than the coincident methods of the match filtering searches. So there is a good science case for the burst searches.
Great, thanks, Duncan. I think we'll have to stop here, so let's thank Duncan again. We will reconvene at 11. Again, a